It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out why a UW project on the frozen tundra of Antarctica, not Lambo, could lead to a new understanding of our galaxy and beyond.
First, at least 35 cities across the country have experienced an increase in murders so far this year, with big spikes in places like St. Louis, Baltimore, and D.C. But Milwaukee's increase has outpaced all of those cities, with 76% more murders in 2015 compared with this time last year.
The uptick comes after years of declines in violence across American cities. Milwaukee's Homicide Review Commission had even been seen as a model program for reducing murder rates. With the increase proving to be a national trend, there have been a lot of theories about possible causes. Peter Scharf joins us now. He's a professor at the Louisiana State University School of Public Health. Peter, thanks for joining us today.
I'm honored. I love Wisconsin.
Oh, thank you. Well, let's put these numbers in context. A big jump this year, but there'd been a talk of a decline from the 80s and early 90s. Are we back up to those really bad levels yet?
No, not generally, though. Milwaukee is pushing it. Ed Flynn's a friend of mine, by the way, so I have to be real polite, the chief. The, I think that actually, if you look at the Homicide Review Commission in Milwaukee, the numbers have been less consistently down. They go up, down, up, down, and then suddenly spike. So the, it's a little different than some of the cities that were claiming to have consistent reductions. But again, the question is, do we know as much as we thought we knew about what keeps homicide rates low? And did the process of debriefing homicides, did they have the effect of permanent declines? No. And the other thing is, there's something going on in the ozone, the political ozone, the crime ozone, the drug ozone, the police ozone, that are producing these results in different cities. The science question for me as a criminologist is, why did these cities go in the same direction? So you have Milwaukee with their increases. Our rates are up about 25%. You know, why are they moving in the same direction?
So let's look at some of the ideas as to why that is. One I've seen you quoted as suggesting is a police funding went up, you said, in response to the bad old days in the 80s. That funding maybe has tapered off, and that could be part of it. Make that case. Is that what we're seeing?
Well, and I think Ed and I were working on some of these initiatives in the middle 90s, the Chelsea police or something. And the they had $4 billion in the crime bill, after the crime bill, from 1994 to 2000, for police projects and police programs, technology, manpower, training, everything. And the and now it's down to under $400 million. So for with the Bureau of Justice System has for the same purposes. And that's a disastrous decline if you want to keep murder rates low. So the hypothesis is very simple, is we don't have the manpower coverage, you don't have the training upgrades, you don't have all the things that made the rates go down from 1995 through 2014. And those reductions were about 30%. Those were very real, very substantial reductions. But if you don't do what got you there, it could rebound. I think what a lot of folks, such as myself, were asking, is this a speed bump, a blip in the road, or is this a tipping point going the wrong direction? You know, Malcolm Gladwell wrote that great book about about the New York murder declines, the tipping point. And no one, I was working in New York with NYPD in 1993, and no one had any clue that the murder rates were going to go down as dramatically as they did. Now is it going the other way? It's a little like the stock market. You get deluded and fat and happy thinking that either it's a permanent bear market or the market's going the way of the bulls. and you can get fooled. And I think we might be getting fooled. It might reverse itself over time.
Talking to Peter Scharf from Louisiana State University's School of Public Health about new numbers out showing increases in homicide rates, not just in Milwaukee, which we've talked about a fair amount here, but in cities, 35 cities around the country looking at possible explanations. Now, you mentioned Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn. He's been in the news saying, looking at the incidents leading to a lot of this violence, it's not so much, drug gang violence. It's not necessarily armed robberies, that sort of thing. It's everyday conflicts that escalate into gun violence. Is this something we're seeing not just in Milwaukee, but around the country?
God, my interview this morning with a TV station here suggested the same thing, that we seem to have solved the gang problems, and a lot of it came through federal intervention, mass roundups, but it's we call them the sole practitioners. That's the problem, and also the beasts. We call them beasts down here. And sort of what is it about the nature of American society right now that has these beasts escalating into violence? And a few thoughts. One, the armaments have changed. Popeye and Olive Oil used to fight with a rolling pin. Right now you're fighting with an AK-47 in some cases. So the increase in lethality of the weapons is probably a part of it. The question I guess criminologists ask, are people fighting more, are they dying more? They're probably dying more and fighting about the same amount of time. The plethora of weapons out there is a factor, I think, a very important factor to look at. But we're seeing very similar patterns here in New Orleans to what Chief Ed noted.
And then one theory that's been suggested, reports from police departments and some analysts, is that, since Ferguson and other police-involved shootings, police are leery, they're reluctant to do searches to get involved, they're more hands-off for fear of the next Ferguson happening, and that's leaving more room for violence to escalate. Do you think there's anything there?
Well, I'd add to it. Well, we have a fancy word for that. We call it depolicing. And that means you sit in your car and nothing bad's going to happen. You're not going to lose your house, your wife, your dog, because the civil rights attorneys or the plaintiff attorneys sue you or you get fired by your police department. And that caution is very much there. Also, the undermanning. We're about 300 officers short of what we ought to have. And Newark, I understand, is 400 off. And so as police officers on the street become fewer, the personal risks of death or injury, as that poor officer in Houston saw, as well as the more punitive climate, and that's where the Black Lives Matter kinds of movements really are hurtful, because police think, hey, I'm not going to get a fair shake. And I've seen Clark on the TV down all over the country. And I think he's right. That kind of thing creates a tone, makes police more cautious, and takes resources out of these hard-hit areas that they desperately need.
And then a counter-argument is it goes the other way, too. If communities don't trust their police departments, they're not going to make that call. They're not going to report the warning sign of violence. They're not going to necessarily think they can get away with cooperating with police officers. How do you bridge that gap between police and these communities where we're seeing this urban violence?
Well, that's where the homicide commission that you have, it's a really good model. I need to really think this through, not so much on the incident level, but the more strategic level, as you're asking. And to get real thought about what's going on in the culture, the police culture and the community culture, so that you can turn it around. But you're right. Passive police breeds passive citizens, and the result over time can be disaster and can lead to the escalations, that tipping point going the wrong way model that we're discussing.
Peter, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm honored. Call me back.
That was Peter Scharf. He's a professor at the Louisiana State University's School of Public Health. We've been talking about the increase in murder rates in at least 35 cities around the country. Milwaukee has seen one of the most dramatic increases this year.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll hear about a new 5-year program designed to address issues of mental health and emotional well-being in Wisconsin schools.
First, a decade ago, the Wisconsin-based Ice Cube Project kicked off construction in Antarctica. The goal was to detect the almost undetectable, the elusive subatomic particle called the neutrino.
In a new paper, researchers say they've confirmed that they've found at least some of what they're looking for, astrophysical neutrinos that have traveled a long, long way, some maybe from outside of our galaxy, that could open the door to a new way of looking at the universe.
Francis Hulzen joins us in the studio. He's professor of physics at UW-Madison and principal investigator for the Wisconsin Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center. Francis, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Well, let's start with the findings in this new paper. How far away are some of these particles coming from?
Well, we are rather sure now that the majority of them, first of all, don't come from the atmosphere, because we made detecting neutrinos easy. We see about one every 6 minutes as I'm sitting here. However, we are not, well, some people are, but I'm not really very interested in those. They are produced in the atmosphere. And we have to look through the atmosphere. It's like when you look out to the sky at night in a cloudy day. We have to look through this atmosphere of about one neutrino every 6 minutes to find something interesting. And so we found this signal of neutrinos reaching us from beyond the atmosphere now more than a year ago. And so the important thing is that we have now confirmed this signal in a totally different way. So I always like to say when I talk about this paper, I now sleep better at night. Because the interesting neutrinos we see, most of them we are now sure come from not even from the sun, not from our own galaxy, but from everywhere in the universe. And so the interesting ones are about one in a million. So we have to sift to a million neutrinos to find an interesting one. And of course, you make a small mistake somewhere along the way and you can easily run into something that you may think is interesting. It's just a mistake. But we convinced ourselves a year ago that we were ready to publish this. But now we have found exactly the same signal with totally different methods. And so that was the paper that was published. You have to realize that this is an instrument that's unique. The conventional way of doing science is that many people do the same thing and they confirm each other. Well, the instrument that's going to confirm what we see is being developed in Europe, but doesn't exist yet. So we kind of did our own check of our own experiment.
So we've got these neutrinos, not from our atmosphere, as you say, from not even from our galaxy necessarily. What can we start learning about our universe from these astrophysical neutrinos?
Well, the game is the following at the moment. We have by now about 100 of these interesting events. And you can imagine that you put these events on a sky map. It's like, you know, we go out at night and we look at the sky and each star is a pixel. For us, each neutrino is a pixel. So we are looking at the universe with a map that has 100 good pixels in it. And so the game is to guess where they come from. And so in that sense, this is also a breakthrough, because the new sample are a type of neutrino, which called the muon neutrino. We actually collect them looking through the Earth. And so the way we can reconstruct these neutrinos with a much better resolution. So these are good pixels, as opposed to our previous discovery, which were cosmic neutrinos, but the resolution of the picture was rather poor. So the exciting thing is that this is probably the start of astronomy. And so as soon as we release this paper, of course, everybody in this field is going to jump on this map, and including us. And we have ideas by now where they come from, but I won't tell you. I want to be sure. Okay. First.
We're talking with Francis Halzen right now, professor of physics at UW-Madison and principal investigator for the Wisconsin Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center, talking about Ice Cube's latest discoveries. And we've been using the word neutrino a lot, but refresh us about what a neutrino is.
Well, a neutrino, it's easy to explain. I said looking at neutrinos coming from the universe is looking at light from stars at night. And so neutrino beams are just like light beams. They are identical for our point of view, except for one thing. They go through walls. They go through the whole Earth, as I said. The neutrinos we collected in this paper came through the Earth before reaching our detector. So at the South Pole, we are looking at the sky above Madison. And so fortunately, they don't all go to the Earth. There's about one in a million will actually stop in the ice and make a nuclear reaction that emits light, and that's the light we detect. And from the light pool, we reconstruct the direction and the energy of the neutrino. So this is a long introduction to tell you that neutrinos are particles that are just like light, but they are special in the sense that they are connected to nuclear reactions. So they are produced in enormous numbers wherever nuclear physics happens. And so they are produced, that's how they were discovered. You put a detector close enough to a nuclear reactor, they are very hard to detect, but you have a huge flux of them. We have a tiny flux, so we make a very big detector. And so that's the idea. This is especially interesting for astronomy in the sense that we are looking at very unusual things. We are looking at sources in the universe where nuclear physics happens. And of course, we know such sources exist because we see the protons, so-called cosmic rays. And these were detected first more than 100 years ago, and we still don't know where they are accelerated or how. And so we'll solve that problem as soon as we can read our map. That's the idea. That's the goal.
Now, as I understand it, there are a lot of neutrinos around us. According to the Ice Cube website, I think it said 100 trillion neutrinos are passing through me each second. Yeah. They don't interact with me in any way, for the most part. So there's so many of them. So what did you have to do, though, at Ice Cube in the Antarctic to catch these?
Just build a big detector. And in fact, none of them interact with you. We talked about the neutrinos produced in the atmosphere. About one of them will interact with you in your lifetime, so you won't get cancer. You're quite safe. But yeah, we just build a big detector, and then we look for very high energy neutrinos, which are easier to catch. But for each neutrino we see, there are about 100,000 to a million that we miss. So when I'm talking about 100 events that we collected in the last few years, you have to multiply that by a million. There are a million we don't detect for every event we see. So by astronomical standards, this is a huge flux. And so we'll eventually figure out where it comes from.
Now, you said you see the neutrinos, but I thought also that maybe they were pretty hard to see and that you only know that they're there from looking at these other particles that they may interact and cause to be born, these muons.
Yeah, you never see a neutrino. It's a neutral particle. It has no electric charge. That's why it's like light. That's why you can do astronomy with it. We see these cosmic rays, but they are protons, or worse, nuclei, and they just swirl in magnetic fields. And so you don't know where they were created by the time you detect them. And so in that sense, you don't see the neutrino. It doesn't interact with your detector. It's only when it crashes right into the nucleus of an atom in the ice that it makes this small nuclear reaction that produces light. And that light pool you collect. So the ice is the detector. The ice stops the neutrinos and converts them in something you see. All we do is put in sensors that allow us to observe this blue light pool. In fact, if you look at pictures from reactors, they are covered with water very often, and that water has this eerie blue glow. That's exactly the light we detect, but it's the light made by one neutrino.
As we wrap up, we're detecting these cosmic signals at the South Pole. Why is Wisconsin at the center of this project?
Well, this project originated in Wisconsin. We started talking about this here in 1987, believe it or not. I gave my first talk on this idea at a small conference in Poland. I would never have dared presenting it at a big meeting. And so we took it from there, and it took about 15 years to develop the project, to develop the concept, and then it took us another 10 years, basically, to get the money and to build it. So I think, you know, by neutrino standards, neutrinos are so difficult to deal with that the natural timescale of anything you do with neutrinos is 25 years.
Francis, thank you so much for joining us. It's fascinating.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
That was Francis Halzen, professor of physics at UW-Madison and principal investigator for the Wisconsin Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center, talking about Ice Cube's latest discoveries. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. As kids around Wisconsin start heading back to class, a new initiative is getting underway at schools around the state. 27 school districts will be taking part in the Wisconsin School Mental Health Project, a 5-year effort aimed at improving students' emotional well-being and mental health.
The State Department of Education estimates that 1 in 5 Wisconsin children are affected by a significant mental health issue that can negatively impact their daily lives, both at home and at school. So where do schools begin to tackle the issue, and what will be explored over the next 5 years of the program?
Here with us now to talk more about the goals of the project is Steve Fernand. He's the Assistant Director of the Student Services Team at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, as the new school year gets underway, so does this Wisconsin School Mental Health Project. Talk about the origins that led up to this project.
Sure. We had an opportunity as a state to apply for a federal grant that's called School Climate Transformation. And it was one of a number of grants that was made available after the tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut. And it was under a large bill called Now is the Time. This particular grant that was made available by the United States Department of Education allowed state departments to apply for projects that would help improve climates in school that would make them more conducive to learning. In our approach, when we decided to pursue this particular grant, we thought that there were a number of things that we could do. First of all, we wanted to advance a number of schools as to where they were on the framework for positive behavioral intervention and supports, PBIS. Become a very popular initiative to look at student behaviors in the state over the last 10 years or so. And as a part of that, we thought we could go a bit further and look at how we could specifically focus on students' mental health. And one of the things that we're aware of is in Wisconsin, we have a higher than national average rate of students taking their own lives by suicide. And we also know that we have a lower than national average rate of psychiatrists that specialize in youth and adolescents as their primary practice. And that one of the things that we might do with this initiative is to improve the coordination of schools' mental health services, not only that they provide directly, but also the relationships they have with community providers.
Well, let me ask about the current state of affairs, Steve. Sorry to interrupt.
Sure.
But looking at the schools, when there are kids with mental health problems, are there many options for teachers and support staff to refer a kid to somewhere?
Oftentimes, there's not a great deal of options, especially in some of our more rural areas of the state. So certainly all counties have have some mandatory services they have to provide under the AODA and mental health crisis response. But as far as those specialty services, sometimes they're very short in terms of what they have available. We think through this initiative we can improve not only the referral mechanism to those services that do exist, but also to improve the capacity of the school staff themselves to early recognize and intervene to be able to provide safe places for those kids.
And let's get into that. So what I know there are some schools participating, some more will join the project later, but what kind of training will teachers and other staff at schools get to, as you say, recognize mental health issues and take those first steps?
Sure. The primary training that we will be providing is in a process called trauma-sensitive schools, so that recognizing kids may come to school having experienced a whole variety of different traumatic events in their lives, and that oftentimes the behaviors they may exhibit may not be because they are being defiant, but it may be because they're reacting to some of those traumatic events. And what we want to do is, through the training, help change adult attitudes about those behaviors and what the origins might be. And through trauma-sensitive schools training, we think that that has an opportunity to change how we not only, number one, identify signs and symptoms that kids may be struggling, but then how we intervene and support them.
Talking to Steve Fernand, he's Assistant Director of the Student Services Team at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction, talking about a new mental health project aimed at helping school staff recognize mental health problems and get students help that they might need. So you mentioned things to watch out for, behaviors, and I saw in some of the information about this, Steve, that sometimes this might be what we think of as acting out or disruptive behavior. Might also be nothing. It might be a student who withdraws and might be harder to detect the problems that they're having.
Absolutely, and that's one of the biggest challenges, is to try to recognize those kids who may be withdrawn on the fringe of the school culture, is that even though they're not making noise, even though they're not making problems, they should not become invisible to us. There may be something underlying that's causing that withdrawal, and maybe depression. And again, that could be because of a traumatic event, or it could be something that's biological in nature. So to some extent, that is part of the training, is to be able to recognize and to be able to intervene and support those kids who may be not saying anything because they're dealing with a mental health challenge. But on the other end, absolutely, there are some of those students who may be reacting because they don't have other skills or abilities really to regulate their behavior, and then all too often that might result in our getting into an adversarial relationship with them and then punishing rather than supporting. So that's all part of the training that will come as part of this initiative.
Let's talk some more about the overall goals here. You can see obvious benefits for the individual students themselves. There's 1 in 5 dealing with some kind of mental health issue. But what about for the school more broadly, the classroom experience for everybody if those issues are dealt with?
Right. We know for those of us who maybe have been either students or in classrooms of our own children that a single student who may be dealing with issues and their behavior is difficult to manage, that can be disruptive to the whole learning environment, the whole learning process. So if one particular student is not getting the help and support they need, it can impact the learning experience of all those students in the classroom. So that's obviously one benefit if we can get that student the help, the support they need. But beyond that, we also may be able to, through our referral mechanisms and getting students the help they might need with the community mental health providers, we may also be supporting that family. If this is a situation which the trauma exists within that family, perhaps through our better coordination, our better communication with those mental health providers outside of the school, we can get the family the support they need, and that could be an added benefit as well.
So in effect, this is kind of a pilot project. Now, how did you select the first two rounds of schools to participate?
Sure. There were a number of factors involved in the selection. Number one was we wanted all of the schools to have a basic framework in the positive behavioral intervention and supports intervention. So that means that they were all operating what we call tier one fidelity. That means a universal approach. They had policies and procedures in their school where they trained staff and they looked to teach or model the behaviors that they wanted rather than reacting with some sort of punitive measure. So all the schools had to be at that tier one fidelity for a PBIS framework. Secondly, we needed a strong building leaders commitment. So the principals had to personally make that commitment that they would be involved, that they would dedicate some professional development time for their staff to participate in the trainings. So having that voice come from on high, that this is what our school will be involved in, was also critical. And third, that there was some sort of infrastructure, that there either was the relationship with an existing community coalition, other partners from outside of the school that were going to be involved in this project, so that it wasn't just schools alone doing the heavy lifting. Those are the criteria that we looked at in selecting the first cohorts.
Apart from intervention in with those particular students who might be dealing with a mental health problem, is there a more general effort to create a positive emotional environment for all the students?
Well, and I think that's what PBIS does in the universal approach. It's not just, again, focused on those kids who may be either acting out or prone to acting out. It's to provide a general positive school climate by making sure everybody understands what the expectations are, providing incentives for those, modeling those behaviors we want, and then making sure that we all, every adult that comes in contact with kids, not just the teachers, but the aides, the bus drivers, the cooks, support that same expectation and provide that same level of incentive for those behaviors. So that's something that we see as important in a universal approach. And then we can look at the more selected or targeted interventions to the kids that need more.
We're talking with Steve Fernand of the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction about a new five-year project that's being launched in schools around the state to address issues of mental health and emotional well-being.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. How have issues of mental health played out in your local schools? What could be done to improve the overall atmosphere for students' emotional well-being? And what questions do you have? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation after a look at the latest news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking right now with Steve Fernand with the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction about a new five-year project to improve students' emotional well-being and mental health in schools across the state. And you can join in at 800-642-1234.
What kind of training would you like to see for teachers, for students on issues of mental health? What aspects of mental health should be addressed first and foremost in schools? What questions do you have about the project? And if you work in the schools, what's going on in your district? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Ruth on the line in Hudson. Ruth, hi.
Hi there. I'm just hoping that your program will include some kind of training for teachers to spot odd behaviors that, you know, may be mental. For instance, we had a child who was constantly seeking the floor, and, you know, not disruptive, just quietly oozing out of his chair and laying on the floor. And it turned out that he had Lyme disease, but the teacher hadn't mentioned it to the parent, you know, that the child was fatigued. Then I don't know if the parent would have noticed either.
Ruth, thanks a lot for the call. So having lines of communication open between school staff and parents on these issues, Steve, is that part of the program here?
Absolutely, that'll be part of it, because one of the things we want all the schools involved in this pilot to do is to develop their own local framework, how they're going to implement their services. There's a couple of different approaches. One is that they better train their staff, their pupil services staff. That could be the school psychologist, social work, nurse, so that when there is a student who has particular behaviors that are either challenging or we don't know what's going on, they can better screen. And that, I didn't really get to that in the introduction, but that's another aspect of this project, is additional training in screening and brief intervention and then referral to the appropriate level of care. So that is one of the aspects of this project, is to help those staff that are designated to provide that higher level of screening so they can get that appropriate level of care for that student.
Ruth, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Nancy with us in Appleton. Nancy, hi.
Hi. I was a teacher, and I also am a volunteer and member of NAMI, which is National Alliance for Mental Illness. And so that is near and dear to my heart. And I really like what is being said and what you are doing. But it's almost to the point now where I feel behaviors, there are so many assorted and various behaviors of children at school that no matter what we do for the teachers, for the parents, it is beyond what we can do. I'm almost to the point where I feel we need to have a school be a whole community service center where the teachers teach and we do document when we notice things. We are somewhat educated as to possible signs of students in needing help. But this all sounds wonderful, but it is so hard to do. And I was a kindergarten teacher, and I had a few students with mental health problems, and I knew it. I mean, it's so obvious. After you have taught for several years and you have hundreds of students, and then because of my NAMI background, and sometimes parents are in denial.
Nancy, I want to bring Steve back in on this. Thank you so much for calling and sharing your experience. This is maybe too big to put on the people working in the schools, she's
saying,
Steve.
Well, there's a great point that a caller just brought up about full-service community schools. There is a model that exists that the state of Wisconsin is exploring, and there was, I believe, a draft bill that was circulated, I don't know if it was ever introduced, that looks at the development of what we call full-service community schools. And as your caller just alluded to, teachers would be allowed to teach, but co-location of services, meaning the health and wellness center, so that those children who may not have other access to primary health care could be placed there, or the community counseling agency providing a satellite in that center. And it might be other services that we can't even envision right now, but there are a number of models around the country that use that full-service community school approach, and there may be some more exploration here in the state about that, but that would, hopefully share some of the burden of the issues that kids come to school every day with, and having those the co-location of those services might be an approach that's worth looking at least on a pilot basis. So I know that we have some discussion just beginning within this department, and that could be an approach that the caller suggests that might be explored more fully in Wisconsin in the future.
And Nancy brought up another point. She said, you know, parents might be in denial about the mental health needs of their children. On the other hand, they might say, hey, this kid's behaving maybe a little out of the ordinary, but let's not pathologize. Let's not put the stigma that is often attached to mental illness on them. So there could be pushback and resistance, maybe with good reason, from parents.
Right. Nobody wants to be ill. Nobody wants to be labeled mentally ill because of that negative connotation and that stigma that causes us often to resist the help that might be available, because we have to admit it's out of the ordinary. It's something's not right here. So with this process, hopefully, again, we can begin by changing those adult attitudes about mental health, starting with school staff, but also extending to parents so that they'll get the help that might be available to them.
We were talking to Steve Fernand from Wisconsin's Department of Public Instruction about a new effort to boost mental health services to spot problems and help kids get help. This is a project that kicks off with this new school year. Back to our callers now at 800-642-1234 with Joanne in Alma. Joanne, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just had a few comments. I've been in nursing for 25 years, and I'm also a grandparent. And what I see is what needs to be in the schools, you know, when I've asked, and I've actually talked to some principals and superintendents, in the local schools, they have one health class that's mandatory. That's eighth grade. High school is elective. There is nothing to teach these kids about coping skills and how to deal with life. And personally, I see many of their parents having problems, and it just kind of falls down to the children. I would like to see screening and health classes every year of their school year put into these schools.
Joanne, thanks. Is this something that's being worked on, Steve, or something that's maybe part of this project, training for the students themselves as part of the curriculum?
Not so much for the students, but there is, as your caller just mentioned, an emphasis on additional screening. And you've heard me allude to screening, brief intervention, referral to treatment. ESPERT is a particular training module that does assist those staff working with students, primarily counselors, social workers, psychologists, nurses, that they can better provide that screening and get the help that's needed. Now, as far as adding more to the curriculum, more required health education, we know it's difficult to add any more requirements because of, and I don't want to get political here, but high-stakes testing and how we have to provide the core instruction. So additional electives or additional subject matters that go outside of core academic areas is probably a tough sell. But I think we can integrate more in those core academic areas, and I think we've seen that with developmental guidance programs at the elementary level, but we also see it in other very, I think, creative and innovative ways in school districts around the state where they're embedding information about how we can manage our own health and recognize what may be happening, but blending that into some of those core academic areas. So I think that probably does rely more on being creative because, again, to try to get separate standalone credit-bearing courses is probably not in the offing anytime soon.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Steve, if this looks like a success after 5 years, is the thought that this could extend to schools all over the state?
Well, I don't know about the ability to provide separate funding for it. We're getting a windfall with the grant. But hopefully what we'll learn is that the benefits of providing better school mental health services, better coordination with community-based mental health services will be something that school district administrators, school boards will say, this is actually a cost savings. This actually helps us with our educational mission, and that they'll reallocate resources they currently have available to help support these efforts. So hopefully the lessons learned, the strategies that are utilized, that are shown to be successful, are things that will be copied all across the state.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Steve Fernand. He's Assistant Director of the Student Services Team at the Wisconsin Department of Public Instruction. He joined us to talk about a new 5-year project aimed at improving students' emotional well-being and mental health in schools around the state.